follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm talking to director Michael Fosty about his latest film, Exit. Over the course of the interview, we talk about the film's class politics, how it touches on Brexit, and whether he was concerned people might be put off by its sheer art horrorness. Plus, we get into Michael's career, directing career as a whole, whether he enjoys acting in his own films, and our joint love of the movie performance. Plus, we talk Scented Candles, which makes a whole lot more sense when you listen to the interview. Something that, funny enough, you can do right now. Hi, Michael. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello, Scott. And thanks for having us.
That's no problem at all. It's good to have you on the show. So, as always, first question I always ask my guests is to give a brief spoiler-free synopsis of the film. Usually I mention what the film is before, but my hosting duties have got all mixed up. So I should introduce that your film is called Exit. Can you give us that brief spoiler-free synopsis of Exit?
I certainly can. Ultimately, I guess it boils down to this. Two couples from very different backgrounds have to spend the night together in a rather strange London apartment, and a night of sex, drugs, violence, and surreal activity follows.
That seems like a pretty good synopsis, yeah.
I was going to say. Who wouldn't want to watch that?
Enticing.
Mm.
I was wondering, how did you first kind of come on board the film as the director? I know it was written by a Matthew Bayliss, who you've worked with before. When did he first like kind of give the script to you, or like did you work on it together, or what was the process there?
We'd made several shorts together. Matt and I worked together, and we'd made a couple of sort of like Matt had helped us with a couple of shorts that we make. My producer is Lou Nosbod, who is also my partner, and Matt had kind of appeared in a short film of ours called Dead Celebrities, and I'd run past him, and Matt himself had written a feature script which he was in the process of selling to a sort of, distributor and production company. And he had spent a long time kind of, learning the craft of script writing. And so I would sort of present these ideas to him, and he would sort of, critique them. And we got to a point in which we just sort of said, could we make a feature film? And we kind of set ourselves a date, which I think, if memory serves me correctly, was round about October of 2017, we sort of said, look, let's see if we can come up with an idea for a film. And Matt went away and I went away. And we kind of had set ourselves a number of provisos. One of them was, firstly, that, the film had to be pretty much a single location movie. The second was it had to have a pretty small cast. And the third was it had to be sort of set in England, I'm a great believer in filmmakers kind of working with what they've got. And, there is no point trying to sort of pretend that, if you live in downtown Surrey, that you're going to make your downtown Surrey look like kind of 1930s New York. You know, you're just not going to. So we just sort of like thought, well, let's try and work with the fact that, you know, we are sort of English filmmakers. We're, you know, both resident in London, and let's kind of go with that and make sort of London and England sort of part of the sort of backdrop. And if you like, sort of subtext to the story. And I went away and came up with this really overly complicated idea, and Matt came up with the idea and the genesis of what would later become Exit, which, you know, is this kind of culture clash between these two couples. Matt wrote the script, and there were sort of several redrafts of it, and I guess I added some of the sort of more surreal elements to the script. And really, we then began sort of casting, let me try and think. So we made it in May 2018, and so we began casting in about January of 2018. So once we had that initial script in place, you know, I sort of said, yeah, obviously I'd want to direct it. And, you know, we then set about sort of putting our sort of cast and crew together.
And how quickly did the cast come together?
I mean, in many respects, looking back now, it all came together sort of pretty quickly, to be honest with you. We got our four principals pretty quickly. We held open auditions up in High Barnet. We kind of, you know, had put a call out on a casting platform, and we were just like deluged with responses, and it was just kind of like, bloody hell. So we kind of ended up with this, in retrospect, fairly long list, which we thought was a short list. And we just ended up auditioning like lots of people, particularly for the role of Michelle. But we actually cast Steve and Michelle on the same day, actually, which were, you know, went on to be played by Billy James Machin and Leonardo Sahani. It took us quite a lot longer to cast Christophe, who is actually played by Christophe Delesque. We kind of wanted somebody who, I don't know, just effortlessly could convey that sort of sense of being European without it feeling a bit kind of forced or a little bit kind of, you know, soap opera European. So we ended up, again, sort of actually approaching a number of actors who we knew were, you know, sort of French speakers. Chris is actually Swiss, so I've got a feeling he's actually trilingual. And he also has done some comedy. And just really, his audition was just a chat. We met up in a cafe in Shoreditch. You know, we'd got him to do a self-tape. But we just sort of sat down and had a chat with a guy. And I'll be honest with you, we've recently been doing some casting for the next project that we're working on. And often, Scott, it comes down to that. You know, you sort of sit across the table from somebody and you have a chat with them, and you just sort of think, actually, do you know what I mean? I can see myself, you know, working with you, and you seem sort of quite responsive. And that really is how it was with our sort of four principles. That really was our sort of guiding principle. You know, can we work with these people? What's it going to be like, you know, with all the stresses of being on set? I mean, there's not really many other characters who appear in it, other than Mo the drug dealer, who is played by my old mate Rob Adams, who I've known Rob for years, and Rob is a fairly accomplished actor, and he's, you know, been in various movies and sort of done some British TV work. And I just sort of, you know, reached out to Rob and sort of said, fancy doing this? And he kind of went, yeah, all right, so long as you don't make me wear any hideous sportswear. So I immediately made sure he was wearing some hideous sportswear. And and then, of course, we're sort of thinking, oh, God, you know, who are we going to get to play our sort of villain of the piece? I suppose there's a few spoilers, which I shall try to avoid doing. And I definitely wanted a Londoner, and I wanted somebody, you know, pretty imposing, you know, both sort of physically, but also in terms of their character. And, you know, good friend of ours, Paul Cockgrove, who runs Horror on Sea, I was chatting with him one day, and he said, well, look, you know, I know Tony Denham. Do you want me to have a word with him? And I sort of thought, bloody hell, yeah. I mean, you know, Tony's been in the Football Factory. In the Name of the Father, it's him who roughs up Daniel Day-Lewis as one of the coppers who's interrogating him fairly early on in the film. And it, you know, I still consider myself really fortunate that you know, in terms of casting, it did just go like a dream, and just everybody just seemed to sort of come together and coalesce really sort of quickly for us.
Yeah. I was just wondering where you were saying all that. So was he always called Christoph in the script? Was that just coincidence?
He was always called Christoph, and when this guy applied for the role of Christoph, it was kind of like, shit, really? The character was always called Christoph, and then he appears, and it was kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, this seems to be fate, so we'll go with it. I'm a great believer in not fighting fate.
I was going through the cast, looking at them on IMDb, see what they've done before, and you know, to recognizing some faces or whatever. And I see that Leonardo is according to IMDb anyway, is her first credit. What attracted you to her to give her the role, which seems like, in some ways, the most taxing role, because like Michelle seems like the kind of audience avatar, you know?
Yes. I mean, I'll be honest with you, we had a number of actors come forward for the role, many of who had, you know, sort of fairly extensive experience, but we always wanted a quality of innocence there, you know, throughout the film. Several references are made to, you know, Babes in the Wood and you know, Snow White and what have you. Mm-hmm. And I did want Michelle to have this kind of innocent quality to her. And as I say, she, you know, there's a bit of a story there, but we you know, she was late for her audition for a start. So already we're sort of thinking, oh, God, right, here we go. And then it was, so, you know, I'm not sure if I'm going to kind of come. And then she showed up late, and we actually kind of almost wanted to dislike her because, you know, she'd been late. But the performance that she put in during the audition was incredible, and she just nailed the character. And we kind of also had a discussion around how she would actually kind of bounce off the other characters. And she's got a real energy about her. And I think when we cast Billy James Machen as Steve, you know, the question you're asking is, you know, realistically, would these people be a couple? And we sort of thought, yeah, definitely. You know, you can actually see these two being a couple. I mean, in many respects, yeah, it was a gamble to kind of give such a role, as you say, such a major role, and really the driving force of the narrative, to somebody who hadn't, you know, who hadn't really had any experience. But, you know, I'm really glad that we did, because I think that sort of gamble, if you like, really did pay off. And I don't think I really could have asked for any more from Leonardo in terms of her performance. It's just right every single time, you know, incredible performance, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was also on the cast. I was curious, you know, you were talking about the casting of Tony Denham, and kind of looking through his credits, like you say, In the Name of the Father, Football Factory, quite a lot of crime dramas, stuff like that. Kind of looking through his credits, you know, this seems like by some stretch the most surreal thing he's been in. What did he first make of the script?
He really liked it, actually, but I kind of had a telephone conversation with Tony, and he sort of said to me, look, you know, I, you know, he hadn't seen the script at this point, and he sort of said, look, yeah, you know, I'm interested in the role, I'm available. I just don't like doing loads of dialogue. It's not something I particularly like doing, but, you know, we basically shot all of Tony's stuff in one day. I mean, you know, he literally just came in, nailed every single scene and then was gone, you know, indie filmmaker's dream, really. Mm. We got all of Tony's performance just literally in, you know, a sort of like late morning, early afternoon, and he was gone by 4 o'clock. And he sort of said to me when I was first talking to him on the phone, look, I don't mind doing it, but, you know, I don't want pages and pages of dialogue, you know, so long as it's not something like, you know, 12 pages of dialogue or something like that, I'm fine. And I kind of went, no, definitely not 12 pages of dialogue. And I got off the phone and I said to Lee Nosbod, how many pages of dialogue has Tony got? And she's counting through the script, and it was 12. It was bang on 12. And I sort of thought, yeah, we're probably going away with that. But But yeah, no, he's given us some really positive feedback, and he's really sort of like pleased with his role. And yeah, it is the most surreal thing. And you know, I think it is something that he did enjoy doing, and it was an absolute pleasure to have on set. And you know, in those early scenes, he does have an incredible amount of dialogue, and he basically sets up the whole narrative in those sort of opening 12 pages. And he never put a foot wrong. You know, I don't think he fluffed his lines once, and I do bits of acting, but I don't consider myself an actor. And I'm just always amazed at how actors can just turn it on like that. And just, you know, every time the camera rolls, they're boom, straight into that mindset of that character. And just a really great kind of person to work with, and a really amazing actor, to be honest with you.
It's always what you want as an indie filmmaker, I guess, you know. It's I was just going to say, go ahead.
Go on, go.
Oh, no, I was just meaning, like, in terms of tight turnarounds and, things having to be done, kind of quickly and stuff like that. You don't want people being problematic or, you know, like, stretching the shooter.
I mean, to be honest with you, as a kind of indie director, you are putting a great deal of trust in kind of the people you cast, because you don't know what they're like. I mean, you know, let's face it, actors by their nature are people who are able to persuade. And, you know, it's only really when you get on set that you start to sort of fully understand, you know, what these people are actually like. And, you know, I've been extremely fortunate in the actors I work with have always, you know, not really sort of been difficult in any way. But, you know, you do hear horror stories. But, you know, as I say, I mean, the budget of Exit is, you know, it's minuscule. And, you know, you really can't have people who are just not pulling in the same direction as you. And that is something that, you know, we shot Exit in 7 days. And I think that would have been, you know, an impossible, it's difficult enough anyway, but it would have been an impossibility if you weren't working with people who kind of were supportive of the project, you know. And I think that, you know, I really can't thank the cast and indeed crew of Exit enough. And, you know, I do keep going on about how thankful I am for the people I sort of get to work with, because, you know, indie film is it's all passion projects. You know, there's no money, nothing's easy. You're not kind of on these great locations. You're making locations fit a narrative that you want to tell. So getting to work with people like, you know, Tony and the rest of the cast of Exit was, you know, a real pleasure, because you've got all those other stresses, and the key stressor is actually the time factor, and the fact that, you know, that you're burning money and time every kind of like second that you're standing on set. So yeah, hats off to all of the cast of Exit.
Mm-hmm. You said you kind of can dip your hand into acting yourself, and you play a small role within the film, simply credited as man on the phone. Were you always going to be the man on the phone, or was that just out of necessity?
I'll be honest with you, Scott, a lot of time it is out of necessity, because, I mean, you know, I'm not an egomaniac, and I want to be in front of the camera and behind it and writing and directing. If I can actually kind of step up and actually take on one of the roles, then that's an actor's fee that I've saved. That's transport costs for an actor that I've saved. And so really, I think, you know, it's not done out of any sort of sense of, you know, narcissistic intent. It's pretty much done, you know, well, if I step up and do it, you know, that's a few quid extra in the budget we get. I mean, really, I would rather not act on screen, because you're thinking about so many other things. But yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest with you, the man on the phone role was one that was born purely out of economic necessity rather than, and also the other thing is, you know, we are very fortunate in the people that we work with, but, you know, at this level, you have to expect people to let you down. And, you know, particularly if you're asking people to volunteer, I mean, I tend not to ask talent to volunteer. You know, we try to always pay all of our talent. you know, but you do get let down. Often you find yourself having to kind of step in sometimes, not in the case of Exit, but sometimes with sort of previous short films we've made, I've had to step in simply because actors who were going to do the roles, you know, let us down. So there is always that aspect to, I think, indie filmmaking that, you know, the famous story in Taxi Driver with Martin Scorsese, you know, his famous kind of turn in Taxi Driver was him having to step in because the actor who was going to play that part, you know, let them down. But yes, I guess the short answer to your question is, yeah, it was always intended for me to play that role, but simply to save some cash in the budget.
Oh, it makes sense. having talked to enough indie filmmakers, that's it makes a lot of sense. I was also going to ask. This film's your debut feature as a director. Did you find much difference between directing shorts and directing a feature?
Yes, massively. To be honest with you, I mean, I think that kind of, you know, you don't know what you don't know until you actually kind of really sort of embark upon a big venture like this. And our rationale was, you know, how much more difficult can it be? It's just longer. But really, the kind of sort of planning that goes into a feature is too, you know, extensive compared to the short. And the other thing is, you know, there are two ways to make an indie short. You either make it in a series of blocks, you know, a week here or a week there, or, you know, or even sometimes weekends, or you try and shoot it as quickly as you can. And so that's what we did with Exit. We shot it in 7 days, and that you know, it takes a toll on you just in terms of, you know, the sheer sort of physical and mental exhaustion that comes with always having to think about the next thing. And the difference between, you know, a feature and a short is there are just that many more next things that you need to think about. So your props list is longer, your costume list is longer. And then when it comes to post-production, obviously that takes, you know, significantly longer. Whilst we were able to kind of, you know, pretty much get Exit in the can in 7 days, it then took the best part of a year and a half to edit this, because I'm sort of editing all my own films as well. So yeah, I don't think I ever really was fully prepared for how different shooting a feature was compared to shooting a short.
Yeah. And even by indie filmmaking standards, 7 days is pretty tight shoot. I mean, a lot of the people I talked to don't have like long shoots, but you know, there's a lot of people who it's like maybe 10 days, maybe even 14 days, you know. So it's pretty tight as well.
Yeah, it was very tight, to be honest with you. And the other thing is, we shot in this, you know, this apartment in London, and it was this freakishly hot week in May. And at points, and this isn't an exaggeration because we counted at points, there were kind of upwards of sort of 13, 14 of us crammed into this flat in, you know, in London. And you know, it's just boiling. And really, that's when it comes hard, that you know, there are certain sort of, you know, there's certain stresses, but then there's also just the sheer physicality of, you know, you're all squashed in, and much of the claustrophobia, I think, you know, that we experience for real, I think does make it onto the screen in Exit, because, you know, it was tough, not just because of the time frame, but just the sheer kind of difficulty of shooting in what is quite a very small space.
I was also wanting to ask you about like the visuals of the film. You know, it's kind of drenched in all these kind of neon colors, and I was wondering, in terms of like influences, what were your influences for the kind of visual look of the film? Because like when I was watching it, you know, I was thinking of people like Argento and Nicholas Winton Refn, Gaspar Noé, you know, people like that. Are any of those like people that kind of influence that kind of visual styling of the film?
Yes, I'm a huge Argento fan. You know, Suspiria and, you know, his early giallos, I just sort of think are incredible movies. And yeah, I'm also a huge fan of a guy, Mario Bava. And I sort of, you know, was watching quite a lot of Mario Bava when I was sort of preparing for Exit. And I can't remember where I heard this, whether it was on a commentary or I read it, but they sort of said Bava to kind of try and get the most mileage he could out of a set or a setting, he would basically use colored gels. So basically, you know, he'd drench a scene with this kind of blue gel and shoot a corridor from one end. And then when he wanted to use it again a bit later in the film, he'd shoot it from the other end and put a completely different colored gel on. And the audience just saw it as a different location. And a kind of light bulb went on. And I sort of thought, well, we're shooting in a flat. And, you know, most flats these days consist pretty much entirely of like magnolia colored walls. So we needed something to kind of break up the background. But of course, you know, this is a hired flat, so I can't start nailing tapestries to the wall or things like that. So ultimately, I realized that gels were going to be the best way to try and create some visual interest there. I'm a huge fan of Gaspar Noé as well. I think that, you know, he's probably one of the sort of greatest filmmakers, you know, currently making movies at the moment. He's always interesting. He's always provocative. And I think his visuals are just always stunning and daring. And, you know, if I have managed to get sort of some of those influences up on the screen, then, you know, thank you, because these are the guys who made me want to, you know, make movies myself. Another huge influence, who I always seem to drone on about at length, so please do stop me, Scott, if I, you know, if I waste your entire day talking about this director, is Michael Powell, who... he's largely remembered for films like The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus and The Matter of Life and Death. And his films were seen as these very sort of, you know, these very sort of British affairs, but there was always a kind of darkness beneath them. And, you know, his kind of sort of go-to camera operator was a guy called Jack Cardiff. But, you know, watching these movies today, the colours really, really do pop. And there's something very nightmarish about these visuals, particularly in Black Narcissus, which, you know, has got to be one of my top 10 favorite films of all time. And that was a big influence, that particular film, when we were planning Exit, because Black Narcissus is a strange one. If you've not seen the movie, it's basically about a group of nuns who kind of go to this sort of abandoned monastery, which is in this sort of like, you know, this sort of border town up in the mountains, and it's kind of between sort of two countries and two worlds. And it's, you know, it's a classic haunted house story, even though this is really a sort of a character explanation. Is it the place or is it the people that are there? And I think that was one of the things I wanted to, and hopefully did explore with Exit, that the place itself is, you know, does exert an influence upon the people who go there. You know, this strange apartment, you know, in London, hosted by this strange individual, but also I think all of these characters are working through their own hang-ups. So Michael Powell, Gaspar Noé, and Argento and Mario Bava certainly were some sort of key inspirations when we were working out how we were going to make this thing look.
Yeah, well, that's you've definitely I'll definitely check out Black Narcissus. I've still never seen it. It's one of those things. It's kind of a blind spot. I've seen like Red Shoes, and yes. I think that might be it.
Have you seen Peeping Tom?
I've not actually. This is what I get. This is one of my major horror blind spots. That's been on my watch list for like years now. So I should go away and watch that as well.
I mean, that is an incredible movie. I mean, from the point of view of the idea of you know, every filmmaker, the idea that, you know, spoiler alert, but he is actually killing people for real on screen as a result of kind of childhood traumas inflicted upon him by his father, who was also a film director. And in the movie, the film director father is played by Michael Powell himself. Sadly, Peeping Tom, which came out in 1960, the same year of Hitchcock's Psycho, ruined Michael Powell's career, and he never really kind of made anything as significant as he had done up until that point. And he was castigated for this violent movie that, you know, seemed to shock everybody. And then Hitchcock makes a very similar film in many respects over in America, and it kind of sort of cements his reputation forever. But yeah, personal recommendation would be Black Narcissus, and, you know, do take a look at Peeping Tom as well.
Peeping Tom is one of those weird films, like, I almost feel like I have seen it because, like, I know the story of it and I've read several essays on it, and you know, it crops up in kind of horror books of like great horrors and stuff like that, and but I've still never seen it, but
One of the things
yeah.
that I really like about Peeping Tom, and another reason why you should see it, is it shows a side of London that was really being shown on screen at the time. So this isn't the London of, you know, Tower Bridge and, you know, red buses and what have you. It's kind of like seedy newsagents where sort of like, you know, dubious looking gentlemen go in to buy sort of postcards from behind the counter with a sort of nod and a wink to the guy who's selling them. And it's kind of showing you this sort of seedy world that did exist, but of course was never shown on screen. And you know, it's almost a point before the 60s and the whole permissive society comes in when all of this stuff is still very buttoned down, or at least it was in the UK. But yeah, it's a movie I've got a lot of affection for and a lot of time for. Still very disturbing, actually. I think that the opening 5 minutes are still a very disturbing depiction of the kind of link between sort of voyeurism and murder, which again is a big theme of Psycho, but as I say, destroyed Michael Powell's career.
Yeah, I was, you know, talking about seediness and films set in the
Yeah,
film set
let's
in
get back
the
to your films, Michael, on the subject of seediness.
No, I was gonna no. You know, like I watched the film and then I read some reviews of your film and stuff like that as well.
Oh,
Both
God, you
from
didn't, did you? God, don't
well,
look at the reviews.
no. No, I was anyway. I was just looking at a few things, and it struck me when I was reading something, and somebody mentioned Performance, the movie Performance, which I think is a great
Yes.
movie.
Yeah.
And and then I was like, oh yeah, I suppose there is a strand of that. Was that in your mind at all, or is that just like somebody kind of seeing what they want to see?
No, it's very much in my mind, to be honest with you. It's probably my favorite film of all time, sort of closely followed by The Shining. You know, there are several sort of, you know, moments, I think, in people's lives when you watch things, particularly if you're a creative, and you kind of go, bloody hell, I want to do that. And I think Performance is, you know, my go-to movie. I didn't see it until I was, God, I don't know, 19 or 20, and it just blew my mind. I'd never seen a film like this, and I never really realized that, you know, film could be anything like this. I'd just seen, you know, some interesting movies, but nothing that really was just as challenging and provocative as Performance. And it's a movie I watch you know, regularly. And it's, you know, if, you know, you ask any filmmaker if you could have made one film, which would it be? You know, for me it would be Performance. I just think it's a movie that really did sort of rock my world. And I just that was, I think, the moment then I sort of thought I really want to make films, or at least have a go at trying to make films, because it kind of sort of spoke to me. And the editing style I still think is incredible, and the sound design, and the fact, I think, that there is a huge amount that is unspoken in this movie. And you know, it's still a very enigmatic movie. You know, it's, you know, what is it about? What is the mutual fascination between these two men? And you know, what's real and what's not. I mean, I think the Mick Jagger character at one point in the movie says something like he gets to learn what's true and what is not. And really, the whole movie plays with concepts around, you know, gender and identity. And at the time, I mean, Warner Brothers hated the movie. And you know, I won't be swearing on your podcast, Scott, but I think it was shown to a Warner Brothers executive who just sort of said, you know, I'll paraphrase him, you know, what the hell is this? And they.
To be fair, I mark all my episodes as explicit, because you know, so it's
Yeah,
you can swear if you
yeah. Okay.
want.
Okay. It's good to know. You're interviewing indie film type, so I suppose you should, you know, might as well just say it's explicit. Yeah, I mean, to me, they were outraged by it, and you know, that I think they thought they were going to get a hard day's night because Mick Jagger was in it. But you know, this is a movie in which, you know, some fairly liberal drug use was going on, and there are rumors and all sorts of things. You had real life criminals appear in the film. You know, it's a movie that really did encapsulate the time, and Warner Brothers sat on it for a couple of years, not really knowing what to do with it. And I think then by the time it came out, sort of swinging London had, you know, stopped swinging and nobody was really interested anymore. But it went on to have this cult following. There used to be in the UK on Sunday nights a show called Movie Drone that was fronted by the director Alex Cox. And every Sunday night at 10 o'clock, Movie Drone would come on and Alex Cox would do a 5-minute intro to it. And there would be a cult film that followed. And that was the first time that I saw performance, you know, one Sunday night in the 80s on a kind of, you know, 4x3 TV in, you know, very poor quality, you know, sort of broadcast. And I just thought, wow, you know, it was a video that I purchased and watched over and over again, and then realized that the version I was watching was a censored version, and then started to try and sort of seek out, you know, the uncensored version. And still, it's a movie. I've seen it on a big screen. I've owned it in every single format. And every time I sit down and watch it, I see something that, you know, I haven't seen before. So, you know, again, short answer to your question was, yeah, performance is a massive influence on my filmmaking. And I guess in many respects, that's the film I guess I'm always trying to make, really. I guess I'm trying to remake performance with, you know, less famous people and a much lower budget.
I agree. It's an amazing film. I first saw it when I was 17, and it was it was one of those things that really opened my mind. I guess in partly because I didn't know that like films like that could be made in the UK.
Yes.
Like yes. I think because like I had a very clear idea of like, oh, we make period dramas, we make kind of Guy Ritchie style gangster films, we make,
yes,
you know, like certain types of comedy films, or we make like kind of social realist kind of Ken Loach dramas or whatever, you know, like nothing against Ken Loach, you know, he's made a lot of great films, you know, but I'm just saying, like, you know, so it's Big Hoosies or Kunsel Estates, you know, it's that kind of thing. And yeah. And then suddenly I discovered like Nicholas Rogue and also Ken Russell, and was like, oh,
yes,
British film can like be this as well. Well, that's
yes.
Weird.
I didn't know. I mean, yeah, Ken Russell is another director who, you know, I greatly admire. And, you know, it's still astonishing. I mean, The Devils, which I think, you know, again, is another one of those movies which you just kind of go, this is incredible. How did this get made?
Yeah.
The fact that we still can't see an uncensored version of a movie made in the early 70s is insane. And Warner Brothers, again, will not release, you know, I'm not sure what the history is, so I need to be careful here. You know, the fact that we are still having a kind of form of censorship of these quite artful movies that were made by a country that doesn't have a reputation for making artful movies. You know, in some respects, you do wonder if both of these films, both Performance and The Devils, would have been made in France by a French director, would they have kind of suffered at the hands of censors, and you know, sort of being often not forgotten, but certainly sort of shelved where we can't see the full versions. You know, we kind of, I think, accept that, you know, French directors will make a movie like Performance and, you know, really push boundaries with sort of concepts of editing and narrative and stuff like that. But when a Brit does it, as you say, it's kind of like, you know, shouldn't you be making some dour movie about somebody on a council estate? And it's kind of like, well, no, I want to make something like this, really. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Scott. It's kind of like, bloody hell, I didn't know English movies could be like this. That's what I want to do.
So, kind of cutting back to your film and talking a bit more about that, you kind of mentioned that, like, the flat kind of has, like, a kind of character itself as well. And there is a kind of sense that, not that it's haunted, but that, yeah, it kind of influences the character. There's like this kind of central kind of class conflict in the movie, and it seems to bring out the kind of worst impulses of all the characters.
Yes, yes, yeah, very true. And that was something I really wanted to work with, the kind of idea that this space that they found themselves in was a kind of accelerant to the worst aspects of their personalities. Right. You know, the way I kind of approached each of the characters was that they had their own kind of hang-ups or sins to a degree. And I'm also mindful about sort of over-explaining movies, because it's not something I particularly sort of like to do. I think mm-hmm. that people have come up with some really interesting interpretations of Exit. And even amongst the kind of production team, you know, we had kind of discussions around what we thought, you know, certain characters' motivations were and things like that. And some people have come forward with some really interesting ideas, particularly some really interesting Freudian ideas about what's really going on. I mean, you know, a question that you always ask yourself as a writer is whose story is it? And I always saw it as Michelle's story, but really Michelle kind of working her way, you know, through a sort of series of characters and obstacles and things like that until she eventually managed to get out. Yeah, I mean, the idea, I've always been sort of fascinated by this idea of, as I say, you know, another sort of go-to movie of mine is The Shining. And the simplistic interpretation of The Shining is it's a haunted hotel. And it's kind of like, yeah, it is. But, you know, you look at, you know, the Torrance family and what they bring with them. And there's just emotional baggage there and history and suggestions of abuse and then there is the idea, has the sort of, you know, the Jack Torrance character, is he an embodiment of someone who's always actually been at this hotel? And in some respects, I think the apartment in Exit, we were playing with those themes and ideas as well. And this was partly achieved because, you know, how else could we achieve it? Through the colour palette. So I always wanted the kind of the colour palette to accelerate as, if you like, the house took over and emotions were, you know, coming to the fore, so all the sort of saturation got pushed up. But yeah, no, definitely the idea of the space actually influencing people is one that, you know, I do actually sort of I do agree with and I do hold true, and it was something that I thought about quite early on in our preparation.
I was also wondering how much, like, I know you don't want to go into too much of, like, over-explaining the film. Like, it's a film, it's one of those films that works on a kind of metaphorical level that kind of the audience members can take what they want from it. But I was wondering how much certain things were deliberate in terms of there's a certain political aspect to the movie, or a certain political aspect you could see in the movie that's in the English couple and a French couple. The, you know, Tony's character at the start cuts a kind of a relatively racist diatribe at times, and the kind of the fog of Brexit kind of hangs over the film, I would say. But is that just me being like a kind of sandal wearing guardianista, or is that something that, you know, like the kind of deliberate aspect?
I didn't realize you wore sandal skirt.
No, I don't actually. I just, you know, like that's a stereotype, isn't it? You know, like I just, you know, they wear sandals, they eat avocados, they read, you know, like I don't know. Like I think that's the stereotype, right? But no, yeah. I don't actually. I don't even own a pair of sandals.
You sure? You're quite defensive about these sandals that you don't own.
I'm getting all riled up about now.
Yeah, my sandals. No, yeah, to be honest with you, when we were kind of throwing these ideas around, yeah, Brexit had just happened and it was hanging in the air, and there was that almost that kind of shock of, has that just happened? Did that happen? What, really? And I think it was a big influence fairly early on. I mean, you know, there were certain sort of things that loomed large, I think, particularly during the writing stage in terms of the consciousness. And one, you know, Donald Trump, and the other, I think, was Brexit. And I think a lot of Tony's dialogue can almost be seen as Trumpian in terms of his kind of, you know, concerns and worries and, you know, the way he expresses himself. But again, I think, you know, Brexit was in the air. It was, you know, it was just continually there. And I think, you know, no writing exists in a vacuum. It's always going to be influenced by what is going on in the wider society at the time. And, you know, we did get some stick from some reviews for, you know, what people saw as kind of sort of crowbarring in some form of social commentary. But I think, you know, it's really difficult to write in isolation of your times. You know, it's a very difficult thing unless you're just not engaging with anybody or anything around you. And I think it is fair to say that Brexit influenced the writing. And certainly, yeah, the fact that we have here a European couple and an English couple who come into conflict, and there is a sense of differing lifestyles. For me, though, I always thought it was more about social class and wealth, and mm-hmm. and the idea of travel versus a kind of insular existence. Fairly early on, there were some scenes which talked about the kind of French couple being seen at an airport or something like that to kind of give the impression that they had literally just arrived in the country. But sort of budget constraints and such things meant that the scene never really, you know, happened. But for me, I think that the class element is also one that is very important to sort of getting a handle on what's going on in Exit, because, you know, money doesn't just simply give you the means to buy what you want. It gives you confidence, and it gives you that ability to deal with situations. You know, the kind of Billy and Michelle characters are quite defensive and are very quickly out of their depth, where the French couple seem to adapt quite quickly. But by the same consideration, I didn't want the French couple and the English couple just to be these very basic binary opposites. So kind of, you know, English equals good and French equals bad, or even vice versa, that, you know, many people sort of see Steve initially as the enemy, and then really he's actually shown to have some sort of, you know, compassion about him. Really, I always thought the French couple themselves were part of this house. I try to avoid giving spoilers, but if you note, the French couple don't actually have any luggage.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. Whereas the English couple do. And so I always kind of felt that they were a part of this this strange ensemble of characters who were living in this kind of house and apartment, and they were sort of part of the fabric and part of the tests, if you like, that Michelle has to go through.
Yeah, that's very curious. I might have clocked that on the second watch, but I think it's not something I clocked.
I mean, all joking aside, you know, we're just talking about performance. I kind of like movies that aren't always immediately apparent on a first watch. You know, I hate movies that over-explain themselves or signpost. I really much prefer coming back to movies over and over again and looking at them and sort of thinking, oh, well, yeah, I've never really thought about that before. You know, I don't want to spend all night talking about movies. But another kind of go-to movie that I really like is The Conformist by Bertolucci. And whenever I'm trying to just work out how we're going to film something in terms of camera shots and blocking and what have you, I always take a look at that movie. But that's a movie that in many respects kind of defies easy interpretation and always seems to just shift. You kind of think you've got what the film's about, and then, you know, almost like trying to grab hold of a sort of particularly slippery eel, it sort of like wriggles out your hands. But again, it's something I like to bring to what we're making, that I don't like easy interpretations, and I would rather create something that stands up to subsequent viewings rather than just is like bubblegum, and he's very pleasing the first time around, but then loses its taste quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, since you premiered at Horror on Sea back in mm-hmm. 2020, and you've had you've appeared at various festivals. I've seen you recently appeared at the Romford Horror Festival. How is the audience reactions been in terms of, like, you know, it is a surreal movie. It is the kind of movie that's probably going to be divisive for people, yes, just because of its art house stylings, and that's you know, it's always going to be more niche. But how's the reaction been? I've certainly seen that you won some awards, and
to be honest, it's been very positive. you know, obviously we got hit by coronavirus, so
obviously
a lot of the kind of live screenings, which, you know, we would have been able to attend, then moved to online. But obviously we got a, you know, very positive reaction at Horror on Sea for our premiere. But even last week weirdly was only the second public performance of it that I'd been to, because whilst there'd been public screenings in the US, obviously I, you know, weren't able to fly out to America to watch any of these. And most of the British screenings had been online. So really, I've only actually been able to attend two public screenings of Exit, which were pretty much over 2 years apart. So we had our premiere, and then last weekend, as you say, we were at Romford. And yeah, it was, it's weird when you watch a movie, because you're sitting there as the filmmaker, you know, holding your breath and just hoping the thing's going to play and everybody can hear it and everybody can see it. So you don't ever really relax until the credits roll. But it was interesting watching it last weekend, because I've always thought the movie wasn't, you know, particularly funny, but I was watching it with, you know, an audience, and to hear people laugh at your film is, you know, in a good way, is always very encouraging. But it, no, it was a really positive screening last weekend, actually. It got played, what time did it start? It started playing at about 10:30 at night. So, you know, I think everybody had had a few beers by this point, which is probably the best way, listeners, to watch Exit. Have a few beers first. But no, yeah, it was really positive. And I really enjoyed the screening, actually. And we had a good, fun Q&A afterwards. But yeah, no, it has been positive. I mean, you know, as you say, it is a movie that is divisive. But in many respects, I'd deliberately go out to provoke people. But I'd always much rather create something which, you know, is not just something that sits in the middle and, you know, you spend 4 years of your life working on it and you say to somebody, what do you think of that? And they're kind of, it's all right. You're saying, oh, I'd much rather provoke some kind of stronger reaction, even if it is kind of like, my God, what the hell was that all about? But yeah, I mean, it's, as you say, it's art house stylings, I think, has put some people off. But then, you know, that's fair enough. And I'd take that in good grace, because, you know, there are movies I don't like, and I totally accept that people are not going to like our movies. I mean, I'm not particularly arch in that I deliberately set out to make obtuse movies just to annoy people. But, you know, my influences are such that, you know, I like to tell a story through a sort of surreal frame rather than just, you know, a very sort of straightforward linear narrative.
It's interesting you thought the movies are not funny at all. I don't think, if for the majority, I don't think the movie is like a funny movie, but I think there's some funny things in it. I think, for example, your character, the man on the phone, is so kind of gloriously obnoxious that it like comes off as kind of humorous. And there's, yes, there's also like a scene near the beginning that, like, really, I don't know what, it really made me laugh. It's like when Tony's talking about he's always got the best flats, and then, yeah, there's this bit where he says he's like talking about describing the bathrooms, and then, yep, he says scented candles, and then like it cuts to him showing off the scented candles like a game show host, and I thought that was hilarious.
I'll be honest with you, that, you know when the audience are on side when they laugh at that. And during our first screening, it was quite quiet up until that point. And then when scented candles came on, and we got a good response to that. And it was the same last weekend. And I can always tell when someone's enjoyed the movies, because they always say to me, scented candles! So, that seems to be something that's really resonated with audiences. And yeah, we got that little scene with Tony, that little cutaway. That was the last thing we got him to do. And I sort of said, you know, things you have to say as a director, do you mind coming in the toilet and kind of like pointing to these scented candles? And he said, oh, yeah, all right, I'll do that for you. So, that was literally one of the last things that we did. But yeah, most people seem to respond to that and kind of get the humor of that it's kind of almost like a bad game show host.
I was wondering as well, I know you've obviously not been to festivals in the States, but did you do any kind of like Zoom Q&As or anything like that? Because I was wondering in terms of like audience reaction, you know, how it went down in the States as opposed to the UK, because it's a very British film, and it like the class conflict within the film is you know, I mean, there's class conflicts in America, but the class conflict in your movie is very particular to British class conflicts.
Yes, I mean, to be honest, yeah, we did do a few Q&As. And really, you know, the risk of, sort of, you know, sounding arrogant, it did go down very well with American audiences. I mean, I think as British filmmakers, we kind of forget that, you know, to people outside the UK, you know, there is something of a novelty to the way we look. And you know, there is you know, something amongst the many American audiences that enjoy the kind of quirkiness of British films. I mean, I think they did pick up on the nature of class, because I think, it, you know, as you say, it is there in America, albeit differently. But I think what many of them picked up upon, I think, was the issues around Brexit, but also the ideas of the past, which is something I like to explore in a lot of the stuff I write, and sort of make that really the idea of the past happening over and over again, which, you know, sadly is something that history seems to sort of bear out. But they did kind of, you know, American audiences did get it, and I was really pleased at how receptive they were. I mean, you know, as I say, it's, I think they see a quirkiness to a lot of British movies in the same way that they like Monty Python, in that, you know, there's a weirdness, I think, that as Brits, we often don't see that we have, that we are this kind of sort of weird island race that, you know, has these hang-ups and concerns, which I think almost seems sort of slightly humorous to a lot of other nations around the world. But no, we had a very sort of positive experience, and I was chatting with one guy, a director called Scott Gergens, who made a movie called 29 Needles, and he was chatting to me about the Napoleon story, about the wallpaper, and his company, I believe, is called Arsenic, Arsenic Productions, and it's named after that Napoleon story. So I think that, you know, many Americans do actually enjoy the sort of European sensibilities that are present within Exit, you know, and I think it is that, you know, it's enjoying the difference, you know, for them. I think that, you know, we are this kind of weird little nation that makes these kind of quirky movies, and you know, whilst it is a very British film in many respects, I think it is something that does still translate, because ultimately it's a bit of a fish out of water story, and it's also that, you know, it's a haunted house movie as well.
So now you've been in a lot of festivals, I was also wondering, is there any plans for Exit to get any sort of streaming release or DVD release or anything like that?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Scott. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are currently streaming on Amazon. And for guys like yourself, it's also on Tubi, which is in the US, Australia, New Zealand. I'm not sure where else Tubi plays, but it doesn't play in Europe. So we're on Tubi. We're on Amazon. You can also buy directly from us. We did our own self-release of Exit on Blu-ray, DVD, and VHS. So if you want to watch the movie, head over to our website, which is Fausti Films, F-A-U-S-T-I Films, it's .com actually, isn't it? FaustiFilms.com. And there you'll find our little big cartel shop where, you know, we ship internationally. So if you're a physical media fan, and we even did a VHS release, and I've got two of those left, so if you want one of those, get a move on. But it's also available on DVD and Blu-ray. And, you know, we've been shipping them all over the world, and anybody who tells you physical media is dead, you know, don't believe it, because particularly for us as indie filmmakers, this has been, you know, this is our kind of sort of mainstay. This is how we get to fund our next film. I mean, streaming is great and it gives you a reach, but really, you know, to sort of like try and make back our budget, physical media has been the way to go. So if you want to support indie film, buy physical media, and particularly buy physical media from me. So that's FaustiFilms.com.
Once again, listeners, FaustiFilms.com.
FaustiFilms.com.
So before we round out the interview, I know you're working on a couple of things. So do you want to tell us about those, your short in Video Chop Tales of Terror, and what is, I don't know, if is it your next feature, Burnt Flowers?
It will be our first feature, and I think this is almost a kind of official announcement. So there you go, Scott, you got yourself a bit of a scoop here.
Scott, exclusive.
exclusively for you, sir, and your sandals that you claim you don't have. What should I do first? Let's do Burnt Flowers. We've been shooting Burnt Flowers in kind of blocks, so we're taking a different approach to how we did things with Exit. We're shooting it in blocks, and I don't really want to say too much about it, simply because I, you know, this one is we're taking our time with, and I don't really anticipate a release for, you know, quite some time yet. But I guess I would describe it as a psychosexual film noir, which, you know, explores some dark places, but again embraces a lot of the sort of surrealist elements and influences that you can see in Exit. So that's Burnt Flowers, which will be a feature. And as I say, we're currently in production with that. We shoot our kind of our next block in April. And then after that, we've got, you know, sort of, you know, several other blocks to shoot, which will continue throughout the rest of this year. And then kind of in between shooting our scenes for Burnt Flowers, we're very fortunate to be involved in the excellent horror anthology Video Shop Tales of Terror, which is being helmed by Sing Lau as producer, and Alex Churchard and Mike Holliday are kind of sort of like overseeing the technical kind of wrangling of that. And I'm one of, I think it's five or six filmmakers who are submitting a segment for that. It's a good old fashioned British anthology movie set around a video shop, and each of us is filming a segment for a particular videotape. As I say, we've still got to shoot our segment, but I'm really looking forward to that because, you know, I'm a child of the 1970s, really. But, you know, so I saw most of my early films on you know, in the 1980s from various dubious outlets on VHS, and got to see quite a lot of very inappropriate material. And I'm hoping to make something wildly inappropriate and offensive as part of my section for Video Shop Tales of Terror, which I think has currently got a slated release of potentially early 2023, but don't quote me on that. We're currently all of us directors. So you've got Tom Rutter, MJ Dixon, Andrew Elias. I'm going to forget people and I'm going to get into trouble. Obviously, Alex and Mike Churchyard. Sam Mason Bell, and we're all kind of submitting sort of, you know, our own particular segment. And Lau very kindly sort of reached out to us and said, look, you know, I like your stuff, would you like to do a segment? And, you know, there was a crowdfunder and each of us has been allotted a budget and you know, given complete creative freedom, you know, which is just amazing. You know, somebody sort of gives you some cash and says, go and make a movie. You know, as an indie filmmaker, this doesn't actually happen. So that's, you know, been an absolute dream to be involved in this project, to be honest with you. And I'm looking forward to making something that is the kind of movie that I watched as a child and probably shouldn't have. So, you know, that's all I'm going to tell about what I'm going to make.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to bring the interview to a close. So it just leaves me to thank you very much, Michael, for coming on the show.
Thank you, Scott, for having me. And, take care, and I'll see you soon.
That was my guest, Michael, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for checking out this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. 5 stars, please. Anyway, that's all for this time. But be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.